Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. I know on Facebook I promised an interview this month with Joy Harjo. Unfortunately, scheduling conflicts have delayed our conversation. I do hope to get to that interview quite soon. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Newman. He's Associate Professor of English at Stony Brook University in New York. And last year, the University of Nebraska Press published his new book called On Records, Delaware Indians, Colonists, and the Media of History and Memory. By way of introduction, a few words on a contemporary indigenous movement with some resonance to what we'll be discussing here. Led by the Onondaga Nation and their allies, the Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign is a year-long educational effort that culminates in a canoe trip down the Hudson River from Albany to New York Harbor that commemorates the 400th anniversary of the first treaty between European settlers, in this case the Dutch, and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, or the Iroquois League, of which the Onondagas are a part. From the sidelines of this important movement for sovereignty and environmental restoration, two academics with a very long track record of dismissing Haudenosaunee oral traditions have called an attendant Dutch document claimed to be written around the time of the Wampum Agreement to be fraudulent. For William Starna and Charles Gehring, only a European document is trustworthy, given that the Wampum Belt that the Onondagas hold records no specific Christian date. These two scholars dispute the 400th part of this anniversary of treaty-making that the Onondagas hope to commemorate. William Starna writes in the Syracuse Post-Standard last summer, quote, "It is our responsibility to point out to people who apparently don't know it's a fake that it is." The response from the Onondagas has been quite consistent. They're not concerned so much with the document, but with their own wampum belt. Chief Irving Paulus of the Onondagas told the Syracuse Post-Standard, "Every time there was an event, we didn't write things down like you people do. We recorded it in a belt. Oral history is what we go by." Organizer Jack Mano, who's working for the Onondaga Nation, dismissed the importance of this Dutch document entirely. He writes, quote, "We are commemorating an understanding of what it means to live together, respecting each other's sovereignty. We are asking New York State and our federal government to seriously consider how it would behave, how it would treat Indian nations and the environment if it honored, in word and in deed, the Two Row Wampum Treaty. We are asking each person to explore the meaning of the Two Row and subsequent treaties for themselves. This is what we commemorate, not some paper record written in the old Dutch language, but a continuing agreement with this area's original people." This episode illustrates a central problematic and theme in Andrew Newman's eloquent new book, On Records. What documents do we consider valid, objective, ideal? How do discourse and power shape our values about these documents? Newman explores several controversial episodes in the historical narrative of the Delaware people, or Lenape Indians, digging into divergent memories of a shared past and challenging the dominant conception of documentation and authority. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Andrew Newman, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the interview.
Sure. So I'm really looking forward to discussing your new book. It's called On Records, Delaware Indians, Colonists, and the Media of History and Memory. It was released last year from the University of Nebraska Press. For reasons that I hope come out in our conversation, I think this book deserves a very wide reading, not only by scholars in English and Native American studies, your sort of home disciplines, or at least where you're making your home now in academia, but I think for historians more broadly. I think it asks some really good questions. It's a very thoughtful book, even if you're not necessarily doing Native history. So before we dig into that material, I'm hoping you can introduce yourself to our listeners and talk a bit about your path to this project.
Sure. So I'm a native of Queens, New York, grew up in New York City, and now I teach at Stony Brook University out on Long Island, living in Brooklyn. And I did my graduate work at the University of California, Irvine. I went there to study early American literature, so I really have a literary studies background. And I was working on a dissertation project that I thought was going to be a literary studies project in many ways. It was on the role of literacy in colonial encounters, and sort of specifically about the meaning of books to the colonists when they were in contact situations with Native Americans as a kind of a marker of cultural identity. But at the same time, I got a graduate assistantship working in Humanities Out There, which is the outreach program of the School of Humanities at UC Irvine. And I was working in elementary schools in a nearby city called Santa Ana. So I was asked to develop history lesson plans, and I developed one on an incident called the Pennsylvania Walking Purchase in 1737. Almost every time it occurs in textbooks or any kind of historical study, it's referred to as the infamous Walking Purchase. So the story of the Walking Purchase is that the colonists asked, these were the sons of William Penn, the Pennsylvania proprietors, made a deal with the Delaware owners of the land in an area called the Forks of the Delaware, where the Lehigh River meets the Delaware River in eastern Pennsylvania. They made a deal for as much land as a man could walk in a day and a half. And it's a very long, complicated history, sort of the terms of that arrangement, which maybe I'll be able to talk about a little bit more later in the interview. The Delawares eventually, after a lot of controversy, agreed to this arrangement to have the tract walked by a man walking for a day and a half. And the proprietors hired really sort of like the fastest men in Pennsylvania. They were the equivalent of Olympic speedwalkers. Mm-hmm. And they had them walk at just a tremendous pace. They took in a lot more land than the proprietors, the native proprietors expected. And it was a cause of a lot of further controversy and, maybe eventually even war. Everything about the Walking Purchase was controversial. But I read about it in the fifth grader's history textbook, and I was surprised to find it there because I thought it was a fairly obscure incident, from my exposure to that point. I designed a lesson in which the students themselves were measuring out a day and a half's walk. I designed a map and had them, count paces to figure out how far a man would walk at a normal pace in a day and a half. And then they really got to choose whether they were going to go, try to take in as much land as possible or try to, be moderate about it and not try to, maximize or optimize the agreement. And they had a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun with it as well. But at the same time, they got to think very carefully about the way language was used in these agreements. So I had some of the students say things like, well, I don't want to cause a war, so I'm going to put in this clause that says they can only go as fast as a tortoise, or that they had to define walking very carefully. Walking means that you don't bend your knee. You don't run when you're going. Nobody over 80 years old can participate in this walk. So those were the students who tried not to maximize the agreement, and others were just walking as fast as they could and marking off as much land on the territory as they could. When it came time to write my dissertation, I returned to my topic of the role of literacy in colonial encounters, but I kept thinking about that Walking Purchase material. And I thought, well, this is also sort of about literacy. Maybe I can just include it. And what happened was it kind of took over my project. When it came time to make the dissertation into a book, I could either write about this material surrounding the Walking Purchase and other stories about the Delaware Indians that I was developing towards the project. One of them was the story about the Wallum Olam, which is... It's another controversial topic in the Delaware's history, but the Wallum Olam was a pictographic manuscript that first came to light in 1837 or 1836. It was produced by Constantine Samuel Rafinesque, was the supposed editor, but from the beginning, people thought that maybe Rafinesque created the Wollum Olam and that wasn't a pictographic history of the Delaware Indians at all. I had that piece, the Wollum Olam and the Walking Purchase, and I quickly or eventually realized that I had a whole book about the Delaware Indians and these various controversial episodes. Another chapter is on William Penn's Great Treaty of Peace, which is the founding story of Pennsylvania, but many historians think that it never took place at all. The story about William Penn meeting the Delaware Indians in 1686 underneath the great elm tree by the banks of the Delaware River. It's a famous picture by or painting by Benjamin West, and everyone in Pennsylvania is familiar with that image. But historians dispute its actual occurrence because there's no documentary evidence of it having taken place. What actually tipped the balance towards the project that I ended up writing as my book was the job that I got on Stony Brook University, because I had a little paragraph really in my dissertation in the Walking Purchase chapter about the story about the first land transaction in New York. It's a Delaware account that was first written down in the late 18th century by a Moravian missionary named John Heckewelder, who lived among the Delawares for decades and became really the primary ethnographic source of information on the Delaware Indians. So the story is that when the Dutch colonists first arrived in New York Harbor, they asked the Delawares for as much land as the hide of a bullock could cover. And the Delawares agreed because it didn't seem like very much land. And then the Dutch colonists took the hide and they cut it up into a long thong and laid it out in a gigantic circle and claimed all the land that it could enclose. I was fascinated by the story, which turned out, as I later learned, is a classical legend as well. It's the story about Queen Dido's foundation of Carthage in North Africa, the colony of Carthage, where she did that trick with the bull's hide. And it's written about in Virgil's Aeneid and in other classical sources. So I was puzzled by how the story could also appear in a Delaware historical account, a native tradition. But in my dissertation, I wrote, well, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. In any ways, it seems broadly symbolic about the kind of experience that the Delawares and other Native Americans have in dealings with colonists. When I got my job at Stony Brook, I became a regular commuter on the Long Island Railroad. And when you're it's a long trip out in Suffolk County. So two stops before Stony Brook is a town called Smithtown. And if you look out if you're heading east and you look left towards the North Shore, you see when you pass by Smithtown, a gigantic statue of a bull. I learned the story about the founding of Smithtown, which was that when it was founded in the 17th century by Richard Bull Smith, he made a deal with the Indians for as much land as he could encircle on his bull Whisper in 24 hours. It's not really broadly accepted as a historical fact, but it's the legend of the founding of Smithtown. So I thought about that story, and I thought about the bull's hide story about the founding of New York, and I thought about the Walking Purchase, and they all seem so similar to one another. One of them is a documented historical fact. The Walking Purchase occurred. You know, there's lots of, the language is all written out. There's eyewitnesses and depositions and so on. The native account of the founding of New York is at least, at best, a disputed fact, whether or not it took place. But then the story of Smithtown made me start thinking, like, there's really some sort of folkloric motif occurring here in all of these various stories. And the Walking Purchase, in some sense, might be informed by folklore. And it started me looking in online journals and doing a lot of searching in folklore publications. And I came across, I don't know, about 10 different instances of the same oxhide story associated with other colonial foundings by especially by Dutch colonists, in, for example, in Taiwan and in South Africa, by Spanish colonists in the Philippines, and by Portuguese colonists elsewhere in the Indian Ocean. And I thought, how is it possible that the same oxide story is appearing in all of these different accounts of colonization at all of these disparate sites? It made me realize I had a real chapter to write about the oxide story. And that was the moment where I decided this was the project that I had to do. That first chapter on the oxide story, the first chapter on the Wallum Olum and the Delaware migration. I'm going to back up for a second.
Sure, yeah.
The story of the Wallum Olum is a representation of another historical account by Heckewelder, or that was first recorded by Heckewelder, about the Delaware's supposed transcontinental migration from a distant country in the West all the way to their eventual homeland in the on the eastern seaboard. So in the Wallum Olum, this account, this narrative is represented by pictographs, but the version that was recorded by John Heckewelder was also used broadly. It appears in James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans, and it's referred to by several 19th century archaeologists, really primarily as evidence that the Native Americans were not indigenous peoples, that they came from elsewhere and settled on this land and conquered the people that were already the inhabitants of the United States. So Heckewelder recorded the story, I think, innocently enough, but it was put to kind of negative political uses. And then when it appeared as the Wallum Olum, the use that I think that it was being put to by Constantine Rafinesque, the supposed editor of the Wallum Olum, was to say, like, wait a second, these Delawares have a system of writing. They have this long, record of their ancient history. This qualifies them as a civilized people who have a legitimate claim to their land and don't deserve to be removed as the Indians were being removed at that time. It appeared in the 1830s, so it was really right during the period of Indian removal. So that's the first chapter of the book. And then the second chapter is on the Bullshide story, which again, I argue by looking at all of these points of cross-referencing that the only way that it could have appeared in all of these sites is if it actually took place, that the colonists themselves were so inspired by classical history that they were emulating Dido's foundation of Carthage in all of these disparate sites in New York, or what is now New York, in India, in South Africa, in the Philippines, and in Taiwan.
Yeah, you have a pretty incredible map at some point in there. I wanted to get into both of those things a little bit separately, but I'm hoping before we do all that and kind of move through some of these stories in a little bit more detail. I was just, you said you were born and raised in Queens, which of course is traditionally Delaware Lenape land. When you were growing up, was there a historical? Did you have a historical consciousness, or interact at all with at least even that sort of popular or school text history about where you were? I ask this because it's interesting to think about it in a place of New York City where you have so many waves of migration and so many changes in the city. And yet, I'm talking to you from Bushwick right now, and you can kind of move through the boroughs and still see Lenape names and things on, streets or something, So I'm just curious it would be interesting even if you didn't have any consciousness of it growing up. But if you can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I like that question. I was recently reading an essay by a literary critic named Jame Tompkins, who referred to her own education in New York. I think this must have been in the 1950s. And she says that she was told over and over again the story about Peter Minuit's purchase of Manhattan for $24.
Right.
That's really New York's founding legend.
Absolutely.
Philadelphia's founding legend is the story of William Penn's great treaty of peace underneath the Great Elm. Then New York, it's this, this real estate steal.
Yeah. Mike Wallace and Ed Burroughs talk about that in Gotham, you know, and how, you know, as a relatively young city, New York, you know, didn't have the sort of shrouded in myth, you know, origin stories of European cities, but this became its sort of creation story in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that they point out that the, whoever was were the parties to that transaction, you know, on the native side, probably felt that they were cementing a strategic alliance. You know, certainly they didn't imagine that they were transferring the land in perpetuity. You know, that they would have to leave after they sold it. But I prefer the story of the bull's hide, which I think is the native counterpart to the Manhattan for $24. You know, in the sense that I think, first of all, it was transmitted over many generations by the Delawares as they moved west, and I don't think that they kept repeating the story about the Manhattan, you know, the purchase of Manhattan by Peter Minuit. But it also affords a very different perspective on this a first land transaction, in a sense, saying that, you know, we didn't undervalue our land. The colonists grossly misrepresented the amount of land that they were purchasing. But back to your question about my awareness growing up in New York, I don't think that I had much. And I don't think that the story of the, you know, I don't remember being taught the story about the purchase of Manhattan, like I think was done very frequently in previous generations. I went to summer camp out on Long Island, and all of the names of the different, you know, bands, they used Iroquois names, or you know, Seneca, Mohawk, and so on. And I think that was done throughout New York State. Maybe in some ways the Iroquois are better known in New York State than the Lenape, who are more associated with Pennsylvania. But in a recent, for my son's generation, for example, he's a graduate of William Penn Elementary School in Brooklyn. He had a whole curricular unit on the Lenape. And it's, I think it's something of an educational revival informed by ethnohistorical studies. And also there's the Manahata Project that was from the Wildlife Conservation Society, this reconstruction, really a digital reconstruction of Manhattan as it would have been in 1609 when Henry Hudson sailed into the harbor. So he identifies the indigenous inhabitants of Manhattan as Lenape, which is a little bit of a, they wouldn't have necessarily called themselves Lenape. I mean, there were various bands, and as I write about in the introduction, the names Delaware and Lenape are in some sense retroactively associated with the indigenous inhabitants of this whole region of New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and so on.
I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about some of the terms you use, some of the operative terms you use in the book, particularly collective memory versus individual memory, and also, you know, language ideology and discourse communities. I know those are all three of those things are all terms that have a lot of literature written on them. But I'm hoping you can sort of demystify those terms a little bit for our listeners and talk about why you use them in this book.
Sure. Well, so I'll start with the first term that you asked me about, which is collective memory or social memory. And this is I'm borrowing it from an interdisciplinary field of study called memory studies. But it's informed largely by sociology, and particularly by a sociologist who published in the 1930s, and then, you know, was translated later, and the translation of his work caused a sort of a revival of this field. His name was Maurice Holbox, and his insight is that even individual memory is always constituted socially. Which is to say, it's constituted through language. It's It's a function of the interaction between individuals in a group, and in some ways, memory is a large factor in the development of group identity. So you could think about it as, I mentioned summer camp earlier. When your friends from camp get together, a lot of what you do together is talk about shared memories, and those who don't participate in those memories, who weren't there then, are therefore outsiders in the group. So that's just a small example of the way that social memory can work. But there's a large literature on the importance of memory to national identity. For example, in the United States, we recently had the film Abraham Lincoln, right? And there's a whole tradition of memories of Abraham Lincoln as a huge symbol of what it means to be American. So I think that there hasn't been a lot of intersection between memory studies and Native American studies, even though a lot of what memory studies is about a lot of what Native American studies is about is memory. They just don't use the same theoretical reference points, and even that term, social memory and collective memory, doesn't come up a lot in the literature in Native American studies that I've read.
And language ideology.
Right. So language ideology is another interdisciplinary field, and it really just begins with the insight that, I talked about the role of memory in forming group identity, but language as well is a large... has a large function in identifying like who's a member and who's an outsider in a group. So even the common phrase, which I remember from growing up, when somebody tells you ain't good English, to say so is a value judgment about what's good and what's bad in language, and it marks people's class identity. The reason that somebody would say ain't good. Good English is to tell you, like, don't sound like a lower class person by using the word ain't. So that's an example of language ideology. But a lot of language ideology also concerns media, and that's really where my involvement comes in, because I'm interested in the values that are attached to different forms of memory or of records. So, for example, when I was talking about the account about the bull's hide, if there had been a document where a Dutch colonist had written down, then we did that trick with the bull's hide on the Indians, it would have a lot more historical. It would have a lot more credibility for historians as an account of an actual event because of the appearance of documentary evidence. But my point is that that's also a language ideology, to say that something in writing is more valid or more authoritative than something that was perpetuated for generations in oral forms as an oral tradition and then eventually recorded. Mm-hmm. Just because you say it's a language ideology doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. But I think it's still important to recognize the value judgments that are attendant on, in some ways, scholarly methodologies.
Sure.
There was a third term?
Yeah, the third one was memory or discourse communities.
I talk about discourse communities all the time with my students because it's a very basic concept. I'm borrowing it from a linguist named John Swales, whose book is called Genre Analysis. It's been out for a long time now. But Swales identifies several characteristics of discourse communities. There's a shared common purpose. There's discourse genres. So, for example, when I'm talking to my students and explaining how we're at this moment in the classroom participating in discourse community, I point out that when they're learning the rules for writing a literary critical essay, what they're learning is a discourse genre that enables their participation in this community. We have a shared language, what Swales calls a shared lexis, meaning that we have terms in literary studies that get used differently in other sectors, even in history or other fields. but have a specialized definition within our classroom. So that's a discourse community. What I lay out in the introduction to the book is that communities of memory, that is, groups like the Delaware Indians and their descendants, or like the original settlers in Pennsylvania, the Anglo-American or German settlers in Pennsylvania and their descendants and so on, historians, literary scholars, we all participate in discourse communities with our own language ideologies and our own media for the perpetuation of memory.
So your first chapter, Lenape Annals, which I actually think is like a very interesting title, and almost suggests some of the points you're making in this book. You open with this quote from William Penn in 1683, who's speculating that perhaps the Lenape are of the Jewish race. He says, "For their original, I am ready to believe them of the Jewish race." You know, it's kind of a striking opening. I had never really heard anybody speculate that in the colonial era. But you know, what does this kind of speculation reveal in this era? And why open with it in this first chapter?
It wasn't such an uncommon speculation. A lot of the, the early, colonial, the settlers, the Europeans who came from the old world, were very puzzled by the appearance. So, once they got over the idea that there was a new world, there's this whole, continent that they hadn't accounted for before. Then they had to account for the fact that this continent was inhabited, because the Bible, lays out, at least you can read for it, the migrations to Africa, Europe, and Asia. The question that's raised by the appearance of peoples in the New World was, how did they get here? Are they of a separate origin, or did somehow they migrate from the Old World? And one of the theories that was propounded was that they were of Jewish origin, that they were from one of the lost tribes. Therefore, perhaps they would be more susceptible to conversion to Christianity. A counter argument or theory was that they were descendants of a barbarous race like the Scythians, who had a very bad reputation in the classical world, and therefore would not be susceptible to conversion, would be perpetually in conflict with the colonists. So there was a lot at stake in identifying the origins of the Native Americans. And eventually some Native Americans like William Apis, Native American writers, sort of joined in these speculations, whether they might or may not be descendant from Jews.
And what do we know about what the Lenapes in this period, in this early period of colonization, were saying about their own origin? And I know that kind of gets us a bit into the Walam Olam and its strange career. But, in this period, at least, were the Lenapes themselves trying to express to colonial leaders their understanding of their origins?
There are two conflicting accounts of origin. I mean, in the earliest period, in the 17th century, there's no record of the story of migration from the far west like we have in the Walam Olam. Instead, what we have is an account of autochthonous origin, which is by far the more prevalent Native American origin story, which is to say, we have always been in this land. We sprung up in this land and, we've never left it. So that kind of story has a larger, sort of claim to indigenous land rights. The story that the Lenapes told to the early Dutch colonists was that they were born on the back of a turtle. At the beginning of the world, a turtle rose up from the ocean. A tree sprouted from the turtle, and then that tree begat the first man and woman, who were the father and mother of the race. So, I think that this is a rather prevalent story in the Native Northeast. In any case, this is a story in which the Lenape have always been on the land where the colonists first met them.
So, you know, I know you introduced and you talked a bit about the Wallam Olam and its perhaps progenitor, this gentleman, Constantine Samuel Rafinescu Schmaltz. It's quite a name.
It's Turkish.
It's Turkish. That's right. So you trace its long, rather odd career all the way up through in 1994 when a PhD student at, I think it was Rutgers, you know, went through very carefully and debunked it or you know, made a convincing case that it, you know, wasn't an authentic representation or something. You know, I encourage people to get the book and read all the details of this fascinating case. But I'm curious if you can talk a bit about what's at stake, you know, in this story, or why you traced its long and strange career. What does it reveal to you? The various ways people have understood and presented this unique book.
When I first heard about the Wallam Olam, I was in graduate school and I was talking about my dissertation project. I had an advisor who suggested to me that I had to find, I was writing about all of these colonists and what literacy meant to them, and I had to find a Native American form of literacy to write about. I was really sort of just beginning in this field, and I read about the Wallam Olam actually in some work of his, just a brief mention of it, and I thought, good, I'll write about the Wallam Olam, this Native American history and pictographs. So I at first thought, as many people have thought, that it must be authentic. And it was only when I ordered David Oestreicher, who's the anthropology student that you referred to, when I ordered his books through, or his dissertation actually, through interlibrary loan, that I read what I found was a very persuasive proof that the Delawares never had anything to do with the production of the Wallam Olam. And instead, most likely, it was the work exclusively of Constantine Samuel Rafinesque. And I developed an argument around this, which was, of course, different from the argument that I anticipated making when I thought that the Wallam Olam was authentic, which is basically that, in retrospect, it seems very obvious that it was inauthentic. What was at stake in supporting its authenticity, and the reason it's been republished so many times and retranslated and touted, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, the Indiana Historical Society did a big study of the Wallam Olam, sponsored by Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical tycoon, and he touted it as the Native American Iliad, like this great book. What was at stake was this cultural credential, the idea that if they had a great book, a history of ancient times, then the Native Americans could claim this masterwork of literacy, and Americans, or the present-day citizens of the United States, could also claim that they had this antiquity that was otherwise missing. But my perspective was that this was to apply a real Western standard of greatness and of cultural value to Native American peoples, and that to single out the Wallam Olam as the one Native American great book was really to devalue other Native American peoples who didn't necessarily have something like the Wallam Olam to claim, you know, as a representation of their past. So I disputed those who would claim that the Wallam Olam is a necessary cultural credential, or that it's very important to demonstrate that Native Americans had writing. To me, the whole argument that if you don't call what their communicative systems writing, you're somehow you know, devaluing them, or that it's derogatory not to call a given form writing, is in a sort of paradoxical way to apply this Western cultural value. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it actually reminds me a bit of a discussion that's going on in a contemporary Native, in some contemporary Native land rights struggles, but I'll return to that in a bit. But no, absolutely. And it seems to be that's one of your, you know, overarching arguments when you talk about literacy and various forms of language representation is that the argument is not necessarily to fit everything into one rubric of literacy, but rather not to devalue other forms of literacy. Is that fair assessment?
Right. And so just to, regarding the Wa'alam Olam, what I'm arguing is that the reception of the Wa'alam Olam was really motivated by this language ideology, wherein the most important thing that you can say about a culture is that it has writing.
Returning to one of the things you mentioned at the outset was this story that is very familiar to school children and textbooks about William Penn, the Treaty Elm. And you write that the persistence of the schoolbook image represents a small victory for popular tradition over professional historiography. That essentially it's a popular tradition that even though it might have been challenged by professional historians, it remains at least in the popular consciousness at a schoolboy level or a school child level. How did that come to pass in your view? And what is it about this story that's illuminating in a similar or different way than the Wa'alam Olam?
I think that the story had a lot of staying power in Pennsylvania, partly because it's a symbol of peace. And that's the way it was sort of proposed over and over again as representing the best virtues of the colonial founders and particularly William Penn. So it stayed on for the first couple generations as an oral tradition, meaning that the initial settlers, those who were there in the late 17th century, told their children, who told their children, about William Penn's great treaty under the elm. We don't know exactly what they said because it was recorded. It wasn't put into writing for a couple generations after it occurred, if it did occur, or I guess you could say after the William Penn's time in Pennsylvania. But then it got this sort of charge and real boost out of the production of the Benjamin West painting. It's an iconic painting, and I think probably a lot of listeners might have it in mind, but this depiction of William Penn and his cohort meeting a group of Indians who are identified as Lenapes, but they're not really wearing the accoutrements and clothing that would be associated with the Eastern woodlands necessarily. But anyway, they're received as such. There's a tree in the background of the painting. It doesn't look exactly like the great elm tree that was once standing by the banks of the Delaware or the Delaware River near the town of Shackamaxon. But there was a kind of a combination of this widely diffused painting, a commendation of the great treaty by Voltaire, who said it was the greatest treaty, and I don't remember his exact language, but in the annals of history between those people, meaning the Indians and the colonists, and the what you could think of as a more organic oral tradition that had been surviving for generations. So in the late 18th century, when Benjamin West's painting appeared, I think there was a lot of need to think about the Pennsylvania origins as being so virtuous. This was a time of the Revolutionary War and breaking with the mother country. There was some doubts about the Pennsylvania's past in terms of its treatment of the Indians. This is now maybe a generation and a half after the Walking Purchase. After the Seven Years' War, when the Lenapes were participating in raids in Pennsylvania, so it didn't seem like Indian relations were necessarily as virtuous and peaceable as the founder might have intended. But by holding on to the memory, they could maybe gloss over some of that recent past. It's perpetuated to the present, just like the story of Peter Minuit in New York. It seems representative of the Quakers and of Pennsylvania virtues. So, you know, as recently as, well, you know, the late 20th century, Pennsylvania governors were referring to this founding legend as the beginning of, you know, of civil rights in Pennsylvania. So they bring it forward, and it's not necessarily referring to Native American relations, but just the spirit of Pennsylvania more broadly.
So I wanted to raise, it seems like there's actually some resonance in your book with some contemporary indigenous rights issues. I was reminded particularly of a campaign that's going on right now, led by the Onondaga Nation and their allies. It's called the Two-Row Wampum Renewal Campaign, which, among other restorative and environmental goals, is based around honoring the 400th anniversary of a treaty between the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois Confederacy, in what's now upstate New York, just around Albany. I've been following the campaign closely because I lived in Binghamton, not far from the Onondaga Nation. And it's been interesting to watch some professional anthropologists chiming in the Syracuse newspaper, for instance, and casting doubt on the treaty's veracity, disputing the 400th anniversary claim. But to me, and you know, frankly, it seems to many Onondagas, that not only belittles their oral and material tradition — they still have the wampum belts — but also sort of misses the point of the campaign, which is not so much about the 400 years precisely, but about the repeated treaty process, the spirit of treaties, which they're calling on the U.S. and New York to honor. That's just one example, but I'm curious. You know, there have been many land rights issues around treaties that raise all sorts of questions about the oral tradition versus the written tradition. And I'm wondering if you see, you know, any resonance, or if you were, when thinking through this book, you could see any connection with any sort of contemporary indigenous struggles, or how you might think through some of those issues.
I can certainly see the parallel to the Onondaga case that you mentioned, and really it's largely about a different way about thinking about memory and records. So preserving and reading the wampum belts, they're keeping a memory alive in a very different way than you know, a written treaty document might do. So, I mean, I agree with your suggestion that, you know, for historians to say, well, this never happened, you know, because we don't have the document proving that it happened, it really is missing the point. Because in some sense, the wampum records are not just a documentation of a past event, but a way of keeping that event alive you know, renewing the treaty over and over again. So the argument that it didn't take place because we don't have the written document is something that I refer to in the book as archival positivism, the belief that if we don't have the document, then it didn't happen. And I don't think that the burden of proof should be on the proponents of an oral tradition to prove that something took place, you know, to find this missing document.
So as we get towards the end of our time together tonight, I want to end, as you do, with the chain of memory, particularly this chain of memory you suggest that connects the present-day Delaware Nation, which is predominantly, or at least its sort of national base is in Oklahoma. And connecting them with this individuals that whose remains were found on Ellis Island and Liberty Island by construction workers in 1985. It's the story you begin the final chapter with that I found was really interesting, and I hadn't known about that. What is the chain of memory that you're suggesting here?
The chain of memory is a phrase that gets used in memory studies to describe an oral tradition. And so, I mean, I'll get to the specific chain that I'm talking about, but the in general, that phrase, a chain of memory, refers to the communication of a tradition from one generation to the next generation, or as I find in the book, it's often skipping generations, where It's the grandparents' generation telling the children, telling the grandchildren, that way, you know, if a generation is something like 25 years, we see something like, you know, 80-year lengths in the chain that can span a very long time. So, you know, as we were just talking about with the difference between the document and the oral tradition involving wampum, the chain has, as the metaphor suggests, more of a connecting value, so that you can, in a sense, map out the perpetuation of this communication over many generations, and it's a chain or a filament that connects one generation to another. It's not simply that the information is transferred, but that you can also look back and say, like, you know, I got this from my grandfather who got it from his grandfather. And that's something that we see all the time in Native American writing, right? It's just not necessarily referred to in terms of memory studies. So I was interested, very interested in reading about the accidental discovery of Native American remains on Ellis Island during the construction of the Immigration Museum, or the renovation of the Immigration Museum in the 1980s. And the parks workers who found these remains, following the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, contacted the peoples who were historically associated with the region, who were Delawares and Munsees. And when the party of, they came from Oklahoma and from Canada, from the, you know, the present Delaware and Munsee communities, back to New York, and it's fascinating reading their account of this visit, because, as you mentioned earlier, there are all these Lenape place names, and there's some sort of, you know, vestigial memory of their presence here, that connection. But I associated the story of the discovery of these remains with the earliest recorded version of the oral tradition of the Lenape ontogenesis, the story about the coming into being on the back of the turtle, which was recorded in the late 17th century by Dutch missionaries. A Lenape or Munsee man named Tantake told them the story. And he's an interesting figure. He was in his 80s already, or at least, you know, that's how they recorded his age. So he'd been alive at the very beginning of colonization, or even before, before the arrival of the Europeans. And therefore he would have had memories of the time before Europeans came. He lived through this period of, you know, of really enormous change. But the point is that the story about the coming into being, the creation story, is in some ways a New York story, in the sense that it is, it's of a land surrounded by water, like the New York archipelago. And it's very different from a story of Oklahoma. It has a sort of association with this East Coast landscape that it wouldn't have had with the lands that the Delawares presently occupied. So we could argue that it preserves a memory of their ancient or ancestral homeland, and it's the turtle, you know, remained a large part of the Delaware ceremonial culture, you know, into the 20th century and into the 21st century. So that it might seem sort of vague, but you can trace a chain of memory that would connect the present-day Delawares in Oklahoma back through those of Tantake's generation, at the beginnings of colonization, and back before, centuries earlier, to the individuals whose remains were buried on Ellis Island. So that's the chain that I conclude the book with.
And it's a very powerful way to conclude the book. So I've been speaking with Andrew Newman. He's the author of On Records, Delaware Indians, Colonists, and the Media of History and Memory. It was released last year from the University of Nebraska Press. Before I let you go, Andrew, I know you just finished or just published this book, which is quite an achievement, but I also like to ask before I let folks go, if you're working on anything now, or at least speculating on anything now, for a next project.
Well, I have all this material left over from the dissertation project that I described to you. Mm-hmm. So I'm making it new, but I am writing about the role of literacy in cultural encounters. And I feel like it's been really very much enriched by my the process of writing this book, what for me has been a great involvement in Native American studies, which isn't where I imagined myself going when I started out writing this.
Can I just ask what it's like to teach Native American studies at SUNY Stony Brook? I ask only because while I'm a graduate of SUNY Binghamton, my real exposure to Native American studies as a discipline was in the South, and which has its own sort of ways of dealing with popular memory and Native American history. So just as a way to conclude, what's that like teaching at SUNY Stony Brook Native American studies? How do students receive the material?
It's a good question, and I'm particularly teaching early Native American studies. I used a book recently on the early Native literacies in New England, which is edited by Christina Bross and Hillary Wiss, and it contains a lot of forms that are very difficult for the students, like a basket, and there's a description of a Pequot medicine bundle. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm stretching the students' ideas of what constitutes writing and literacy. I don't think that the students bring a lot of knowledge of Native studies, to the class. So it's very new to them, and I think it would be different teaching in the South. It was interesting for me being an early Americanist in California, where there seems such a dissociation between the region and the field of study. So for the students at Stony Brook, I think probably a lot of them had experience like I did growing up with some familiarity with the names of the Haudenosaunee tribes, so-called the day camp experience of Native American culture. But beyond that, I think it's very unfamiliar material for them, and especially the early stuff. So some of them asked me, are you going to be talking about shamanism that they're ready to read like the 20th century Native American literature, which might be a little bit more familiar with them, something like Smoke Signals, the 19th and 19th century and earlier is pretty foreign for them.
Interesting. Well, Andrew Newman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the interview.
You've been listening to a discussion with Andrew Newman, author of On Records, Delaware Indians, Colonists, and the Media of History and Memory. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past interviews free of charge, or on iTunes, where you can download the podcast. We're also on Facebook, where you can leave comments, questions, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.